You're listening to the EFCA Theology Podcast, which exists to help pastors and church leaders stay passionate about the gospel and faithful to the scriptures.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. I wish I could be with you in person, but I can't because of a scheduling conflict. But I've been asked to share with you all some of the biblical material related to immigration and migration worldwide. And the challenge that we have today in a world where literally hundreds of millions of people are migrating all over the world is to try to think through this topic very self-consciously as Christians. There's all kinds of things in the news, whether we're talking about politics or the economics of it, some of the cultural and religious challenges that come with this. All these things are important points that we need to get to. But what we need to do as Christians is to begin to think through these topics, these really pressing and uncomfortable topics. Think through them biblically and lay the foundations for our discussions as Christians. And that's what we're going to do in our time together today. Now, one of the fascinating things that we find in the Bible when we come to the New Testament in particular is that migration is actually used as a metaphor for what it means to be a Christian. We see this in 1 Peter chapter 1 and chapter 2, where we are all called to be strangers in a strange land, that we are foreigners in a very different kind of place. We're aliens, the Apostle Peter tells us. Now, what's interesting about that is that this underlines for us the importance of this topic. It is so important to what it means to be a human being, actually, that it is used as a metaphor for the Christian faith. Now, what that tells me is the more we understand about migration, the more we understand about immigration, the better we'll understand what it means actually to be a Christian, what it means to be strange, to be a foreigner. And immigrants would know this in ways that aren't just about metaphors. They would know it in their experience. They know what it means to speak, let's say, with an accent. They know what it means to come from a different place and maybe have issues of being different culturally and also with legal standing and all kinds of things. They know what it means to be strangers in a strange land. So let's go into the Bible and see what it has to say about migration, about immigration, and about immigrants themselves. Now, one of the things that I try to underscore when I am speaking to people about immigration is that we need to understand how much the Bible has to say about the topic. What happens when I share with audiences of the majority culture is the reaction that I normally get is, wow, we didn't know that much was in the Bible. Well, it's all over the place in both Testaments. When I speak, for instance, to Hispanic audiences, I get an interesting reaction that's like the majority culture, but also something more. I get the, wow, no sabíamos que esto estaba en la Biblia. We didn't know all this was in the Bible. But the extra piece that we get when we share these things with immigrant populations is, no sabíamos que estas eran nuestras historias, que nosotros mismos estamos en la Biblia. We didn't know that these were our stories, and our stories are in the Bible itself. So as we talk about these narratives in the Bible, as we talk about Old Testament legislation, as we just begin to mention some New Testament things, realize that if you are the majority culture, this will be an entry into the world of the Bible, and maybe all kinds of new things will come at you and open your eyes to what the Bible says about immigrants and immigration. But if you're listening to me today and you're from an immigrant population, whether Hispanic or whatever other kind of population, enter into the Bible not only for that information, but also to begin to see that this is the biblical story. The history of humanity is the history of migration. This is the history of every country in the world. So we're not surprised that we find migration in the Bible itself. But what you begin to see is that God accompanies, God works with and walks with immigrants, as we see in the scripture. So I want to talk briefly about what the Old Testament has to say and then move even a more briefer look at the New Testament. When we go to the Old Testament, we can kind of divide the discussion into two large sections. The first would be the narratives of the Old Testament, and the second would be Old Testament legislation. Now, what we need to get to is the legislation, even in this country, but the narratives will help set the stage for the legislation, and then the Bible will give us some interesting pointers and direction for thinking about legislation. Now, when we come to the Old Testament and begin to think about the narratives, what I would want to do is begin in the very first narrative itself, because very important to this whole discussion of immigration is where we begin the discussion. It's not uncommon for believers, evangelical believers, to begin the discussion as the national discussion would have it, which is legal status. Do you have the proper papers? Did you come in the right way? Which are important questions. But what that does is focus on legal status. And we can get to legal status and how to engage the government once we get to, let's say, Romans 13 or something. But if we begin our discussion in the very first biblical narrative, in Genesis chapter 1, we begin to see a different starting place. We begin to see that we need to begin the discussion with the concept of the image of God. Every human being, even immigrants, are made in the image of God. And now we're going to begin the discussion with their humanity. We get to legal status later, but we begin the discussion with their humanity. When we go into Genesis 1, what we learn is that being made in the image of God really has two major points. The first point is that every human being is of infinite worth because we're made in the image of God. So when we talk about immigrants, what we're talking about is are creatures that are unique and valuable in the sight of God. The second thing that we learn in Genesis chapter 1, if we go to the image of God verses, which would be verses 26 to 28, we begin to see as we read that we are created for a purpose. There we are created to rule and to govern the earth. Now we're not only talking about human worth, we're talking about human potential. And so if we begin to come to the immigration discussion with the idea of the image of God, we begin to see immigrants not only as valuable in the sight of God, but also with all sorts of potential for the national good. Now, just to give how this could impact the discussion, if we're talking about legislation, for instance, the discussion in this country about the Dreamers, the DACA legislation, for those young people that came with their parents. If we begin with the legal status, it would not be uncommon to hear discussions about how much they need to do and what kind of punishment they have to go through if they are at all to be allowed to be in this country. But if we begin with their worth and their potential because of being made in the image of God, the question now becomes, how can we facilitate the incorporation in the integration of all these young people into the country, which is the only country they really know, for the national good? Now you're talking about legislation, but legislation with a very different direction, a very different tone, and a very different set of principles that underlie it. If we move on in the Genesis narrative, we find a whole series of fascinating narratives. Let me just mention a few. I wish I had all kinds of time to show you and to share with you all the relevant narratives in the Old Testament, but let me just highlight a few. The first would be Abram. Abram, at the end of chapter 11, begins to move from Ur of the Chaldees, and he and his extended family, they go up to Haran, which would be kind of today in the Turkish-Syrian border, and then they come down into Canaan, in Genesis chapter 12, in the opening verses of chapter 12, he receives the promise of God to be blessed so that he might be a blessing and his descendants be a blessing to the rest of the world. All that sounds very good, and he begins to move into Canaan and build altars and call on the name of the God that has called him, Yahweh. But if you keep reading that narrative in Genesis chapter 12, which you also find about verses 9 or 10, is that there's a famine in the land. And what he and his extended family do, his wife and his nephew and probably the slaves or the people they have that work with him and their animals, they begin to move to Egypt to look for food. To stay in the land would be to have hunger. So they begin to go to Egypt. And Egypt was kind of the breadbasket of the ancient world. You have the Nile, and so you would have water, and so you would have crops, and then harvest and food. And so Egypt was dealing all the time with people trying to move in, at least for short periods of time, for food. This isn't any different. But we also know from archaeology that the Egyptians had built a series of forts on their eastern frontier, probably to monitor this movement in and out of people coming to look for food and perhaps work. So it may have been as Abram and Sarai were getting close to one of these checkpoints, to one of these forts, that we have that infamous kind of exchange between him and her, where he says, look, if they ask you, tell them that you're my sister and not my wife. Now, she accepts that, and they're able to get in. Now, if we step back for a second, this is quite the migration or immigration story. Because what we find are desperate people. A desperate people who are willing to lie to get across a border to survive. She takes on the greater risk, which is not uncommon to hear stories about women crossing borders. She takes the greater risk because she literally is putting herself bodily at risk in terms of Pharaoh so that the rest of them can eat. It's a clever ruse because in the ancient world, if there was not a father to whom someone could ask for the woman's hand, then it would be the brother that they would have to ask for her hand. In this case, in this clever ruse, the brother would have been Abram. So what you see him doing is buying time for all of them, even as she's putting herself at risk, all of this, so that they can eat. So have we ever thought of Abram as a migrant or immigrant story of a surprising kind? If we go to later on in the narrative and to Joseph, he is taken into Egypt, not because he wants to go, kind of a forced migration. He's sold to some traders, and then they take him to Egypt, and he ends up at Potiphar's house. And what we find is that he integrates very well. He's a hard worker. He's probably picked up the language and the customs, and he works his way up the ladder until he becomes the steward of Potiphar's house. You know how the story goes. Potiphar is away on a business trip, and his wife tries to seduce Joseph, and he runs away. Now, if we were to think about this culturally, what we find is not very strange, because he is the one who is arrested, because who are the authorities going to believe, the Egyptian woman of a well-known official or this immigrant worker? So he's the one who ends up in jail. But as you know, he interprets dreams and things like this, even Pharaoh's dream, and he comes out, and now he's second in Egypt. The Egyptians give him a new name. They give him a wife, and he has children by this Egyptian woman. But when he names his sons, he gives them Israelite names, not Egyptian names. Interesting. What you're seeing is he's still holding on to his culture. When his brothers arrive, also looking for food, and they're willing to pay for the food, they're brought to him. And he understands them, even though he pretends that he doesn't because he has an interpreter there with him. But then he goes behind the curtain, as you know, and he weeps. Now what we find there is that he has not lost his mother tongue. He's very much what we would call now assimilated, but he's holding on to some cultural roots, his children and his language. Now, it's interesting because we would ask, well, why can't his brothers recognize him even as he recognizes them? Well, in that culture, the Egyptian culture, a man of that stature would have been shaved, and then it would have painted his face, and that's probably why they don't recognize him. But he recognizes them. You see later on some other cultural heartstrings that are being pulled. the most obvious is that he tells his brothers that when he dies, he wants to be taken back home and buried along with the rest of the family. And there's this very poignant scene at the end of the book of Genesis. The book tells us that the Egyptians hated and despised shepherds. Well, that's what his background was. His father was a Bedouin. But when Jacob comes with the rest of the families that are the families of his brothers, he presents his father to Pharaoh. So here is this man who has made it in Egypt. He comes from a very humble and despised background, but he presents his father to the most powerful man on the earth. And so we wonder, what were his feelings? What was that like for Joseph? Was he embarrassed because of his background and of his parents? Doesn't seem like he was. And then what we see is that Jacob will bless Pharaoh. So this humble Bedouin immigrant, now moving in to the Nile Delta, blesses this powerful man. Interesting immigrant story. Have you thought of Joseph as an immigrant? If we turn the page into the book of Exodus, we find the dark side of the immigration stories, because there we see in the opening verses of Exodus that the Egyptians feel threatened by the growth of the numbers of this foreign population. Very natural, very human response to kind of a different cultural presence. They see this as a political and even a military threat. Again, we can hear echoes of that in our culture today in different parts of the world. And so what they do is they put into place all these kinds of draconian laws to control the foreign population, in this case, to even kill the little boys. That doesn't work, as you know how the narrative goes. But what they begin to do, again, which something which is very natural and very human, but makes no cultural sense, no economic sense. Well, it makes cultural sense, but not economic sense. They begin to say, look, you have quotas to build and to make bricks for our buildings. But now you've got to find your own straw. That makes no economic sense. These bricks were not for Israelite buildings. They were for Egyptian buildings. Putting straw into the bricks would have made them strong and stable. They were making it harder for them to work, even as they needed their labor. A cultural reaction with no economic sense. This is the kind of tensions that we see worldwide. How do host populations receive the foreign population, and how does that work economically? Fascinating scene there in the book of Exodus. We can move on to Ruth and Naomi. Naomi, in the book of Ruth, as you know, begins the book by moving to Moab with her husband and her two sons. They are the immigrants looking for food. There in Moab, her two sons marry Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth. But as you know, the men die. Her husband dies, Naomi's husband, and the two sons. And now you have three widows. Orpah will stay behind, but what you have with Ruth now is that she will accompany Naomi back to the land of Judah, to Bethlehem. And now the woman who had married an immigrant, now she becomes the immigrant. And the story of the book of Ruth really is the story of the assimilation of Ruth into the little town of Bethlehem. It's a fascinating story. I wish I had more time. But what we see is bit by bit, she gains the favor of Naomi. She gains the favor of the women of the town who in chapter 1 ignore her, but in chapter 4 praise her. She gains the favor not only of Boaz, but of the elders of the town in chapter 4. And then what you find at the very end of the book is a genealogy of David that will come through the line of Ruth, through Obed, this son. As I look at that book, it strikes me that Obed would be what we might call a half-breed. a Moabite mother, a foreign mother, and a native-born man from Judah, Boaz, as his father. This is my story. My mother was a Guatemalan woman who married an American. In a sense, I'm Obed. I didn't have to go through what my mother went through. I didn't have to go over all those barriers that my mother had to go through. I am Obed. And in this country, you're seeing more and more of us, of the ones who are coming from these marriages, cross-cultural marriages. But from this very humble line, we find the genealogy of David, which ultimately leads us to Jesus Christ. We see this in Matthew chapter 1. So we find from immigrant stock, even the Messiah will come. We could keep on giving you all kinds of stories. I wish I had more time again in the Old Testament, whether we're talking about people like Daniel and how he integrates, or Ezekiel, or Ezra, Nehemiah, as they come back to their land. Esther, of immigrant stock, but who doesn't want to come back, but we see that bit by bit, she begins to regain her cultural identity to save her people. All kinds of fascinating immigrant stories at multiple levels going on in the narratives. But what we see in all of these stories are challenges to faith as well as the presence of God. Let me move to legislation. When we move to legislation, it's fascinating to think about how the Old Testament law engages the foreign presence. Now, if we go to the ancient law codes that we have today, there is almost nothing at all that deals with foreigners in those laws. That's what makes Israel's law so unique. There is a lot of legislation dealing with the foreign presence. In the ancient world, a foreigner, especially in ancient Israel, would have several challenges. One is, in that world, there was no safety net that was in place for the government. It was to be the responsibility of your extended family to take care of you. If you got sick, or an animal got sick, or you had a bad crop, or disease, or something like this. But the foreigner would not have an extended family, particularly vulnerable, therefore, in that ancient world. They would have to look to the Israelites, in whose country they had come, for help and support. But the other challenge that they would have is that Israel was primarily a peasant economy, an agrarian economy. Most of the people of that time, maybe 90% or more, would have been small peasant farmers. But the Old Testament tells us that these foreigners would hardly have any chance at all to buy land. They would have to go for work at the mercy of the Israelites. Very vulnerable people. And what we find then in the Old Testament is that the law has all kinds of legislation to meet these needs. And there's two motivations to meet these needs in the Old Testament that are important that I want to mention in the few minutes that we have left. The first is, God says, don't forget that once you were slaves in Egypt, that once you were immigrants. And if we go to this country, we begin to see some of the dark side of our immigrant history. This is a picture, you can see this from the 1880s, 1890s. And our first piece of major legislation in this country about immigration was the Chinese Exclusion Act. And here what you have in this picture is a cartoon. And what we have in the cartoon is a wall. Now, this is a metaphor for back then, the idea of keeping the Chinese out. But what was then a metaphor in this country has now become a reality on our southern border. What has changed is the nationality of the ones we want to keep out. But this was the Chinese Exclusion Act, 1882, not rescinded until 1943. Here's the picture of how Irish were accepted or not accepted when they first came. You can see there that the Irishman is portrayed as violent, the Irish Frankenstein, that he's almost like an animal. And of course, what complicated it back then was the fact that they were Roman Catholic. Here's an interesting picture from about the same time period, about 1890. And there's the national narrative. On the one hand, that column says, United States of America, welcome, admittance free. But there you have Uncle Sam holding his nose in front of the immigrant. And because of what that immigrant is portrayed like, we think he may be an Eastern European Jew. But you can see what he carries in his hands, disease and poverty. And here's the story of our country. This narrative of acceptance and suspicion. In fact, if we go back to that Chinese Exclusion Act, 1882, that's the very same decade that we put up the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. That's our national narrative. So how do Christians respond to this? How do we respond to the foreigner? The last and second motivation that the Old Testament has is that God says in Deuteronomy 10, verses 17 to 19, that you will love the foreigner because I do. I don't know what greater motivation that we need. God loves vulnerable people. Vulnerable people not only because of our hearts, but because of our legal status and because of our economic and social need. We don't really have time to move into the New Testament, but I hope our quick survey has given you a touch, a sense, a taste of what you have in the Scriptures. Jesus himself begins his life as a refugee as he flees Israel in Judea to move to Egypt for a while with his family to escape certain death. And eventually he'll move back. And we find all kinds of stories of people on the move in the New Testament as well. So I hope that this is just a good introduction to this whole topic. I hope that as the conference goes on, you'll have more time to think about these things. And I hope as you move into the future and work with immigrants or work with churches that serve immigrants, that you will begin to sense the heart of God for these vulnerable people. Thank you again for this wonderful invitation. Again, I wish I could have been with you. And may God bless you. Bendiciones, hermanos, en esta conferencia. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the EFCA Theology Podcast. You can find more episodes by searching EFCA Theology Podcast in any podcast app or on the web at efca.org/podcast.